This is KHOI, Story City Ames and Surrounding Community.
Welcome to Local Talk Thursday,
where we explore the people, places, stories, and events of our Central Iowa community. Thank you for tuning in. I am Mike Metz, your host for the hour, sitting in for Ann Kinzel. KHOI station manager is with me, Mike Murphy. He's at the controls monitoring that warm glow of our vacuum tubes. Today we will see partly cloudy skies starting out, but it'll get sunny. We're going to have highs of around 66 degrees Fahrenheit. The winds are going to be 10 to 15 miles an hour out of the west-northwest. This evening skies, however, it'll be partly cloudy, and we'll get down to a low of about 39 degrees with winds south to southwest at about 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, however, it's going to be a nice sunny day and highs in the 60s again. Our current temperature is 33 degrees, and sunset this evening is at 6:25 p.m. And we're going to go to a phonology that Pat Schillerbaum put together talking about juncos, part of that snowbird group, like snow buntings that I saw as I spent some time in northern Wisconsin yesterday.
Phonology is recording nature's happenings when they occur. The first cicada of summer or the last flock of barn swallows in autumn are noted in a journal for future reference and comparisons from year to year. And as Lee Searles writes, phonology is the study of natural cycles in the lives of living animals and plants. Today's phonology is about dark-eyed juncos at our bird feeders. With recent autumn frost, new arrivals from our north are joining us. Dark-eyed juncos are neat, even flashy little sparrows that flit about forest floors of northern states and Canada, then flood the rest of North America each winter. These birds carry a northern wildness where wolves, eagles, and loons flourish. They're easy to recognize by their charcoal color with white bellies and crisp markings. There's bright white tail feathers they habitually flash in flight, and of course their eyes are dark, hence the name, dark-eyed juncos. They are called snowbirds because people believe their return from their northern breeding grounds foretells the return of cold and snowy weather. Another source of the nickname snowbird is the junco's dark gray back and white belly, which has been described as the leaden skies above, snow below. Young of the year, or young from this year's nestings, have breasts that are streaked brown. Their calls include tick sounds and very high-pitched tinkling chips. It is known among bird language practitioners as an excellent bird to study for learning the bird language. A New Hampshire study of foraging habits of the juncos found they spent 65% of their time on the ground, 20% of their time in shrubs, 16% in saplings or low trees, and were rarely observed in the canopy of large trees. Adults, especially females, tend to migrate in fall earlier and farther. For example, in Michigan, winter flocks are 20% female, and in Alabama, they are 72% dark-eyed junco females. And how to tell males from females? Bear with me on this. Females tend to stand more upright, with thinner necks than the males. Also, males have a head that is a bit more rounded than females. These traits are subtle, yet fun to study your juncos under your feeder to tell the difference between females and males. And while you're studying birds of your community, juncos are the true hip-hop artists, under your feeders, bouncing along as they forage, with a rhythm all their own. Juncos can only persist in their favorite habitat of pines or mixed hardwood forest. They migrate south, arriving in their winter quarters between October and November. Often the juncos show up with additional migrants like white-throated and white-crowned sparrows that contribute greatly to our bird-feeding family. Juncos, with most other birds, love black oil sunflower seeds. They winter here, then depart to nest from mid-March onwards, and almost all are gone by the end of April or so. This explains why the males do not migrate as far south as females. Males are more territorial and do not stray long distances from their nesting sites. Now is the time of year to enjoy these birds in the coming days as autumn slips through pastoral displays of grandeur for the season. And that is our phonology for today about dark-eyed juncos in Iowa. Theme music is from John Barleycorn Must Die by Traffic. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOY Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. Become a member or find the donate button at the website khoifm.org.
Without a little bar.
And thank you, Pat Schlarbaum, for that phonology. I'd like to welcome now Linn County Auditor Joel Miller, the Democrat candidate for Iowa Secretary of State. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning.
You're running for the Iowa Secretary of State. What prompts you to want to do that?
Well, there were several things, starting with getting sued by Donald Trump in summer of 2020. That was one thing. And then basically coming out of a great election that we had in 2020, we got kudos from the state, from the federal office holders and so forth as to how well the election was ran. And then in March of 2021, there was election legislation. I call it anti-voter legislation that was introduced that basically put a lot of restrictions around vote by mail and early voting. And we're dealing with those today. Yesterday was the first day of early voting, and today it continues for the next 19 days. So, and the lack of leadership by the current Secretary of State in basically addressing this anti-voter legislation and really sticking up for voters' rights.
So, what I'm hearing from you is that you are a county auditor who's in charge of this type of an issue, and you're saying, why fix something that isn't broke? Is that kind of a good way to look at it?
Well, that's correct. I mean, there was a lack of evidence and a lack of facts of things that occurred in Iowa that might have justified the law if they in fact had happened, but they had not happened. The laws are based upon rumor and innuendo of things that supposedly occurred in other states, and then as time went on, it was proven that those things didn't occur there either, and that was decided by judges and juries and testimony and so forth. That a lot of the things, a lot of the laws that we have now, are based upon things that never happened.
Okay, we in Story County have a situation where we've got a vote by machine, but there's a paper copy that then you submit into the box for. So you've got a paper trail as well as the machine. Is that something that you have in Linn County as well?
Are you talking about a paper ballot?
Well, it's a copy that you can see that can be slipped in after you've made your vote on your machine for tracking purposes.
I'm not sure what you're
okay.
talking about.
Well,
we vote on paper ballots.
Yeah.
When you're voting early, you're voting on an absentee ballot.
Correct, which is
and
paper.
And you are putting that inside an envelope and you're turning that in. And then, you know, on election day and maybe the day before, if you have too many of them, you count those paper ballots. But the express vote, which is for disabled people to use, has a white sheet of paper. And the results of your votes, who you vote for, is printed on that paper. And then that is slipped into the machine on election day, or again, put into an absentee ballot envelope for the early voting period.
Okay, that's where my confusion was. So, okay. As Secretary of State, what are some of those things that you would address?
Well, I've already addressed a couple of things, trying to work within the existing structure right now, like publishing absentee ballot request forms in a newspaper prior to the election, trying to level the playing field for all people who may not have access to the internet, may have not have access to a printer. So I've done that. In Linn County, our offices will be open all 20 days for early voting. As Secretary of State, I would publish APSE ballot request forms in newspapers across the state so that everyone had equal access to those forms. And I would also direct county auditors to extend their hours since we only have 20 days. And if you observe the weekends and you're not open then you're further taking away from those 20 days. So those are things you could do without making any changes in the law. But if I was allowed to do other things, well, one of the things I wouldn't need anybody's permission for would be to basically protest any further anti-voter legislation that might come along. Somebody might think of introducing. I would stand as a barrier to anything that didn't put voters first, made it more inconvenient for people to vote. But given the opportunity to introduce legislation, I would advocate for registering 17-year-olds at the point that they turn 17. Just automatically do it. It'd be efficient. It would save a lot of paperwork and time on the part of county auditors. I would advocate for allocating absentee ballot drop boxes by population and not by county, which they are now. That's not fair to do it that way. Everything else in government is allocated by population. Why not drop boxes? I would advocate for a voter guide for voters so that they knew before they got to the polls who they're voting for, what they're voting for. I see so many people fiddling around with their smartphones trying to figure out who to vote for when they're in the voting booth. That's not the time to do it. Yeah. Let's do like other states do and send that a guide out to people so they have a place to start to look up information on candidates, on ballot issues, and so forth, so that they're not confused when they get into the booth.
One thing that a lot of folks, a lot of voters are a little upset with is the time that your ballots are accepted, and that's currently now with the law, it's the day of election, correct? And there's a deadline. How do you propose for those folks who get their ballot in time, but perhaps it didn't get picked up in time, like the post office, for example?
Right. That is, you know, our system of vote by mail is based upon delivery by the post office, and we don't control that. And we all know that there's been a management decision within the post office to slow things down. Not the postal workers. They didn't decide it. Management decided to slow down the delivery times. And these laws that were passed in 2021 basically ignored that and said, too bad, we don't care. We used to have 40 days of early voting in 2016. It moved to 29 days in 2017, and now we're down to 20 days. So they shortened that window up. And then they went and shortened another window up, which was, you could request an absentee ballot up to 3 days before the election, and then it moved to 10 days in 2017, and now it's 15 days. So people are getting caught both ways. I mean, they've really made it complicated. Think about, you know, the art of driving down the road. You know, you kind of have to know a couple of rules, but in elections, you got to know all the rules or you're going to get caught up in missing some deadline, which is then going to force you to vote via another method. So if you miss the vote by mail deadline, then you're going to be forced to either early vote or vote on election day. Well, if those two means aren't available to you, or you're a shut-in and you miss the deadline, you don't have any choice. You're probably not going to vote, and that's already happened to people. So we have a system that is excluding people, and I'm just the polar opposite. I want every eligible person to vote in our elections. I think that's better for our democracy. I think it's better for accepting the results when you've had a high participation rate. And that's what I want to see, and that's what I advocate for, is everyone voting, not just people picking their voters.
Along those same lines, you mentioned shut-ins, folks that have disabilities where maybe they can't get down to the poll and they have to vote via absentee ballot, for example. Can you just briefly review where we were and now where we are as far as getting help to deliver those for those folks?
Well, that is another provision of the new laws that I view as negative, or that they did, and they've made it sound so negative when they talk about ballot harvesters. Ballot harvesters used to be your friends and neighbors who stopped by to pick up your ballot, to take it and drop it off at the county auditor's office, and now The only people that can take your ballot are people that are in your household or relatives. If you're a disabled person, then someone can be a designated agent to come by and pick up your ballot. But again, this all presumes that you have requested the ballot to be delivered to your home, and you've made that request no later than, in this case, Monday, August 24th at 5 p.m. If we don't have your request in by that date, we cannot send a ballot out to you. Therefore, no one can pick it up from you. And if you're shut in and you and the doctor said you don't leave your house and you can't even do curbside voting, you've been disenfranchised. And there's no provision to allow the auditor's office to go to those shut-ins homes like there is with people in nursing homes. We send a two-person team there, but we can't send a team to independent people living independently or people living in assisted living. Those people are on their own, unfortunately.
Okay. In the last minute or so, could you just review and share something with our listeners that really concerns you, maybe an interest, but overall highlight the message that you want our voters, our listeners, to take home with them?
Well, I think what you're looking for as Secretary of State is someone you can trust. And unfortunately, my opponent endorsed Rudy Giuliani in 2007. He invited Donald Trump to a fundraiser in 2015. We have a lot of disinformation being promulgated right now out in the social media and everywhere. And I've asked my opponent to disavow Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani, and he won't do it. And it's causing a lot of turmoil, especially with county auditor's office. And it's forcing us to each county auditor, like myself, to defend these allegations that are undermining their democracy. I mean, they're hitting right at the heart of our democracy and our government here in Iowa. And I'm totally opposed to that. And we need leadership in the Secretary of State's office, and we need someone we can trust. And I believe I'm the best person to have that job and to do that for the voters of Iowa.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning. That's Joel Miller, the Democrat candidate for Iowa Secretary of State. Good luck. And again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be on your show.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next guest is Ted Rasmussen. He's the candidate incumbent for Story County Treasurer. Good morning, Ted.
Morning, guys.
You're in charge of our county money, to put it bluntly. Describe a little bit about what the Story County Treasurer's Office is about, please.
Okay, so the county offices were kind of all split apart years and years and years ago to more or less provide a little bit of check and balance on each other. So they split apart the duties of each office, and the duty of the treasurer's office is to collect and store and safeguard the county's assets. We say assets instead of money, but it's pretty much the same thing. And it's our job to kind of be the banker for the county. So various departments, as they bring in money to the county, whether that's the conservation office through the parks, whether that's other offices, and then particularly property taxes. We take that money and we store that. And then the auditor's office is who's allowed to spend the money. So when they're ready to send out claims and send out money to pay for the county's various business, we pass that money over to them at that time. So it's a nice way to keep too much power from being focused in one area. So at some point along the line, the state decided we want to start collecting money for car registrations and car titles. And those county treasurers are all over the state collecting money already. So let's recruit them to help us collect some money for vehicles. So then we also collect money and then act as an agent on behalf of the DOT to do those car titles, do car transfers and registrations. So the big focuses of our office is to collect those property taxes, collect the revenue from car titling and do those processes, hand out license plates, and then just kind of act as the banker for the county and keep that money safe.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you a question or two a little more pointed about some of those responsibilities, but tell our listeners somewhat about your background. Now, I know that you're a lifelong Story County resident, but some of our listeners don't. Share that with us, if you would, Ted.
So I grew up on a family farm east of Colo. It was my mom and mom's family farm. It was a century farm that I grew up on. At about the age of 10, we moved 8 miles away to my dad's family farm. My dad has farmed his whole life, and that's kind of his hobby. And my mom worked over in Ames, so we've been in Story County. The both of them have lived here their whole lives. Both their grandparents lived here their whole lives. I went to Colonesco, graduated, went on to Simpson College down in Indianola, and I had 4 years there in my life where I wasn't in Story County, back every summer. But then after college, I got a job in Des Moines, and my wife had a job in Des Moines, so we moved to Ankeny for a little bit, and we both went to Drake and got master's degrees. And after that, I was lucky enough to come back up to that family farm that I grew up on in Colo, lived there, and my daughter was actually the seventh generation to live in that farmhouse. And it was a great spot for a lot of our family, but you know, there are challenges with a 140-year-old farmhouse. So recently, my wife and I moved up to the family farm where my mom and dad are. We built a house up here, and we just love Story County. She still works at Iowa State now. Great place to raise your kids, to set roots, and have a family. And it's really an amazing spot to grow up and to live. And you know, I love being here. Love serving the people of Story County.
Obviously, you're a great asset, it sounds like, for the county as far as your interest and love for the area. Now, getting down to some of those specifics, property tax comes to mind, and we all reluctantly pay that. And I know that when Paul Wearson comes on, he's always crying about his property tax here on KHOI. But in a nutshell, why do we pay property taxes? Where does that go?
It's a good thing you said in a nutshell, because I know people might be driving into work right now, and I don't want them to fall asleep if I get too long-winded. So property taxes is an interesting process. The primary recipient of our property taxes are our public schools, and then our cities and our counties. And because it's the school that is the primary recipient, property taxes are collected on the fiscal calendar. In other words, we're collecting them from July 1st to June 30th. And that's why we always say your first payment is due in September and your second payment is due in March. So that's kind of why that works, because we're actually going from July 1st to June 30th, kind of like the school year. So the important thing about property taxes is your city and your county and your school and some other entities, they budget for the whole year. And we do this, we're going to actually start shortly in November, and we'll complete our budget for a year ahead in March and get that approved by the state. And then beginning July 1, we're working on that new budget year. And in order to meet those requirements, you know, whether that's plowing the street, whether that's fixing potholes, whether that's, you know, every day maintaining the gravel roads, that money needs to come in throughout the year. So we collect that first payment in September, and we distribute that to all those entities that get that, you know, your Colonescos, your Gilbert School District, your Ballard School District, and then also to the cities, Cambridge, Collins, Roland. And we get that money out to them, and then they're able to follow their obligations, whether that's provide police and fire support or other things. So really, property taxes is key to the local government that really makes our world work. Those things we're used to and we need, you know, here at the very local level.
Sure, and I would assume that secondary roads for sure are part of that recipient. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? So the next time somebody grumbles about a road or a bridge, but then also grumbles about the tax, well, it's kind of a thing there, right?
Yeah, great roads are not cheap. We all got to contribute to roads, and I believe we're somewhere north of 270 bridges in Story County. That's a lot of bridges to maintain.
Right.
I think 750 miles of roads that the Story County maintains. That's not counting like Highway 30, Highway 65, 69, and I-35. 750 miles, I believe, of just county-maintained roads.
And when you have well-maintained roads, you have less maintenance on your vehicles.
Yeah. Okay. Yep, that's an important piece, too.
So we've talked a little bit about the infrastructure, public schools. We had one instance in a small community up in Zering where they didn't file in time, but people still in that area are responsible for paying their property tax. How is that work into the mix here? Is that something that you could comment on, Ted?
Yeah, so when you pay your property taxes, basically, like I said, every different area creates their budget. And their budget is based on what they need to operate for that 1 year. And then the assessor, everybody's favorite person, the assessor, assesses the value of the homes and the properties. And based on the amount of budget needed and the total assessed value, each entity says, this is what our tax rate is going to be. So on the auditor's webpage of Story County, it has a really good breakdown of all those different tax rates. And so it gets a little complicated math-wise, but more or less, if you live in the city of Ames, you can you pay a little bit to the city of Ames, a little bit to Ames School District, a little bit to Story County, and a little bit to the local hospital. When that happens, your money all comes in one pile in property taxes, and then we distribute it out to each one of those entities. In Zering, the city of Zering did miss their date, so they were not allowed by the state of Iowa to set their tax rate. So basically, we still collected on behalf of Colonesco School District, on behalf of the county, on behalf of the Story County Hospital. We still had to collect those portions of taxes. We just didn't collect the Zering portion of taxes. So those Zering taxpayers paid a little bit less this year just because they weren't paying anything into the Zering budget.
Okay. That clarifies some questions that I've heard in the past. So thanks for that. One other thing, and that is, I don't know, with the school funding, do you have any say or any influence on or thoughts on public school monies going to public schools versus other places?
So this is beyond the scope of my office. Our office is just, its job is to collect and distribute. The one commentary that I will make just as a person looking at public schools is public schools are a great, great example of locally run government. A school board is elected right there in the community, and that school board has a say in what happens in their school, and those are elected by the people who live in the school district. I would be very, very hesitant. I wouldn't be very excited about public school dollars being spent at a private organization that has no oversight from the public school board. And that's what scares me about the bills. Right now, any money we collect publicly through the property tax process, every single entity that gets that is controlled or managed by a publicly elected board. When you start giving that money to private schools that have no, they don't have any oversight or responsibility to report to a publicly elected board, I don't think that's a fair way to use people's tax dollars. Okay. I think that people should have a say in the election of the people who are spending their tax dollars.
Very good. In the last 30 seconds, Ted, just sum up why you should be reelected as treasurer of Story County.
I just feel like it's a huge honor to serve in that position. I feel like in the last 4 years, I have learned an incredible amount. Keep learning every day. And the Story County Treasurer's Office collects a little over $166 million. And in that office, we need somebody who's responsible, somebody who is open and transparent with the public. And I think I have good qualities to be responsible for that money, to take care of people's tax dollars, and to make sure that the office runs efficiently and well for the next 4 years. So I would really be honored if people would vote for me this year. And thank you guys for having me on this morning.
Thank you for joining us. That's Ted Rasmussen. He's the incumbent and candidate for Story County Treasurer. Good luck and have a great day, Ted.
Thanks, you too.
And now we're going to welcome Ames Police Chief Jeff Huff. Jeff, I'm not Ann in disguise. I'm sitting in for her this morning. So welcome to Local Talk this morning.
I kind of figured Ann didn't grow that mustache. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. We're talking a little bit about, there's an upcoming event having to do with mental health. Could you address that as our first talking point this morning?
You bet. So the city has been working on putting together a series of mental health discussions over the next about 6 months or so, just to address some of the issues and get information out there for everybody. And our first one was actually on October 4th, mm-hmm. and the subject matter was suicide. So it was a very heavy meeting. We had a couple of mothers that were there that were discussing sons that had completed suicide. And so that was a tough one. The next one is going to be about mental health education and resources. So we want to get information out there about what the resources are here in Story County and a little bit about educating people about what they can do. And so we had to change the date on that. So we had been advertising November 3rd, but we just found out that that's the same night that the school district is having like school district-wide conferences. And so we want to make sure that people are able to go. And so we decided we'll slide it back a little bit to November 7th still at the same time.
Okay.
It's 6:30 at the water plant, which is out on East 13th Street. Mm-hmm. And again, we'll be talking about resources available, educating the public about how to use those resources. Then there'll be a little bit of a break because, you know, we've got Thanksgiving and some other holidays right. coming up, and it doesn't work well to try and have those things during that time. So we're going to put the next one in January on January 31st. And that one, we're going to talk about resiliency. I think all of the mental health providers and other people we've been talking, and we just sort of see a lack of resiliency lately. And people need some skills on how to handle disappointment and things like that. And so that's what that one's going to focus on. Then we're going to go to March 7th, and we're going to talk about drug use and abuse. And then we should be back to the library. So I think the only one that's going to be at the water plant is this next one in November. Then January, March, we should be back to the library to do those. And so we know that there's a lot of people in our community that are struggling with use and abuse of drugs and alcohol. And so this will kind of give them an idea of what resources are available for those kind of issues. And then April, we're going to talk about civility and conversation. This is one of the ones I'm actually looking most forward to, maybe. We have just seen a total lack of civility all the way around in our society. No one can stand to listen to a viewpoint that they don't hold anymore. Social media has just become garbage when it comes to all that. And so we're going to just talk a little bit about that, you know, how to respectfully disagree, just how to have conversations again. I know when I was a kid, we used to sit around the kitchen table and have dinner, and we would discuss things, and we would sometimes disagree, and no one had to leave. No one had to be kicked out of the family for not maybe agreeing with everything. And then we're going to wrap up on May 2nd with navigating the mental health and substance use system. So these systems sometimes can be difficult to navigate for people. And so we're going to try and give you some tips and resources on how to just to navigate that system, how to get through it, how to get people help that you love. So that's kind of the whole conversation list that we're going to go through over this next about 6 or 7 months.
Okay. And so we'll have that on our website for folks to get those dates as well here later this week. So, yeah. Chief Huff, I'm curious, really interested in the second piece that you were talking about as far as the resiliency that'll be coming up, especially after the holidays. I know for some folks that can be a really tough time, you know, depending upon how the family situation is, those things, and the weather. You know, there's that seasonal affective disorder that hits many of us actually up here in the northern climes. But is that something that'll be addressed at that? Do you know?
Yeah, we'll be talking a little bit about that too. We know we're coming right out of the holidays, and while that provides an opportunity for people to get together with their family and their loved ones, and that brings a lot of good things, it can also be a stressful time of year. And it can be stressful for students too. When we get close to the end of the semester, you know, which is really in December, but when we get close to the end of the semester, we have some students at Iowa State and even, you know, our high school and middle school students that get pretty stressed out. They've got tests to take, and the holidays are coming up, the weather's changing, so there's kind of a whole bunch of things that are happening at the same time. And so, yeah, we'll address that, but I think what we're seeing more and more of is people are just having a hard time overcoming obstacles. And so we sort of want to talk about what are some strategies you can use when things don't go your way, and try and you know, keep it from getting worse, I guess. And so I think as a lot of us as parents made some mistakes, we tried to remove all obstacles from our kids' path. You know, they used to call them helicopter parents because you're always hovering over your kids and trying to protect them. Well, now the new terminology is like bulldozer or lawnmower parents who try and remove all obstacles from your way. And, you know, we're doing it out of, I think, love for our kids to try and make their lives a little bit easier. But in essence, what we've done is we've made it so they are not very good at disappointment because we've not let them fail sometimes. And I think we learn a lot from our failures.
I've got to mention something here, personal situation where, gosh, as a kid growing, I can remember Dad was always saying, oh, this builds your character. And he was saying that. I was 35 years old, and I one time asked him, when's my character going to be built? Because he was still using that term when we do something together. That didn't turn out. Yeah. So,
funny. We talked to some of our educators and even some of our employers, and when things don't go, you know, a kid's way, parents are on the phone advocating for them, probably when they should stay out of it. You know, we've got people that didn't get hired for a job and they're in their 20s and their parents are still calling that business to try and, you know, that's a bad recipe. So I think we're just trying to figure out how can we help people with resiliency get back to the point where it's okay to fail because we learn more from our failures than we do from our successes. And so I know for a fact, my mom and dad never defended me about anything when it came to school. They figured if I got in trouble, I deserved whatever I got. So,
and it was okay for the neighbor it was okay for the neighbor to say something too, because we
very much so,
because everybody was looking out for their kids in the neighborhood. That's for that. That's what how I grew up. Even though we moved a lot, but let's talk a little bit about the Ames Force as the season starts coming up with the holidays and that. Do you see more, is it a routine, or do you have to up the situation a little bit to prevent holiday doing? What goes on with your department during those times?
Yeah, I think just in general, the fall is our busiest time of year now. But I think a lot of that has to do with school starts, and then there's football season, and the weather is still very good through usually, you know, about the end of October. We usually have pretty decent weather.
Yeah.
And so activity is up a little bit. And so really that this fall time of year is when we are at our busiest. And then when the season changes a little bit, it cools off, there's fewer people outside. Our activity starts to drop just a little bit, and then it picks back up in the spring towards the end of the school year. So, you know, our calendar really revolves around the ISU calendar.
Okay.
Kind of how it is. But yeah, you bet. Around the holidays, we do see sometimes an increase in mental health calls. I know that there's sort of a rumor out there that there's more family violence calls around the holidays. We haven't really seen that so much in our area, but it certainly happens all year round. And we want to make sure we have the proper resources available. And if I could, I'd like to give a plug for a new resource that's out there that just started this last week. And so it's called ARCH. And ARCH stands for Alternative Response for Community Health, A-R-C-H. So we've got to have an acronym for everything. So ARCH is ours, and it's a good one. So this is a partnership. It's actually funded by Mary Greeley Medical Center. They saw a need in the community that wasn't being filled, and we're doing a six-month pilot program, and we're supporting their program right now. So ARCH will go out to mental health calls, welfare checks, those kind of things that don't require police officers. So we're trying to remove police officers from every single mental health call for service. So ARCH is going to start taking those. And the really good thing about this program is because we're supporting it, the calls for service will still come through our communication center. So you don't have to know a new number or anything. So if you call into, you know, our 911, mm-hmm. if it's an emergency, or the 515-239-5133, which is our non-emergency number, and you need some mental health resources, we may send ARCH instead of a police officer. We also might send mobile crisis. But what we found is mobile crisis takes a little bit longer to get there. And so if it's a little more critical, we're probably going to try and go to ARCH. And if we've got time on our side, maybe we'll go to mobile crisis. But we've got this other resource. And what they're going to do is they're going to a paramedic or an EMS person and a social worker are going to go out on these calls.
So it's not just the social. It's not just the social worker going out there without some other aid in case the situation would expand or that kind of thing.
Exactly. And if there's a medical issue along with that mental health issue, you've got someone that's trained, you know, in emergency medical. So this is a really good model. It's been used in a lot of places. We didn't really come up with this idea on our own. We saw what other people were doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is going to be a good response. And the other thing is, since they're being dispatched by us, they're on our same radio system. So if they do need additional help, they can talk directly to the officers and get additional help. They can let us know what's going on, all those kind of things. So this is a really great model for Ames. We think it's going to be really successful. They've been going for about a week, and we've already kept them kind of busy, which we weren't surprised by. But it is a pilot program, so we're going to be looking for funding towards the end of the 6 months to make sure that we can continue this, because I have no doubt it's not only going to be effective for our citizens, but it's going to be a really good thing.
Oh, gosh, that sounds like a intelligent thing to do, is to take something that's been working someplace else instead of trying to reinvent the wheel, as it's often said. So kudos to the department for doing that, Chief.
And it's really Mary Greeley is the one funding it. So they get a lot of credit for this.
Sure.
We've been working with them, but, you know, they're actually putting a dime on it. So.
Very good. Very good. Well, kudos to them as well. One last thing that I want to ask you about the seasons and the change of seasons. And I'll bet the officers get out their little pad when it comes to the first snowfall and people have to remember how to drive.
Yep. That's coming up probably sooner than we'd like. It's that time of year to start thinking about winter driving and making, you know, a lot of this is, you have a little bit of time, hopefully, before it gets here, but this is the time to really make sure your vehicle is well-maintained. Check those tires. Bald tires are terrible on water and snow, and so if it's time to replace your tires, bite the bullet and replace them, because otherwise you're probably going to end up meeting somebody new alongside the road, and that's not the way you want to meet new people.
You don't want to make new friends that way.
No. Well, you get to meet us too, which is awesome. But your insurance company doesn't like it so much, and pretty soon you're going to respond. So, yeah, this is a good time to start making sure that those things are happening. Well maintained vehicles are helpful, and just slow down.
Sure.
Most of the accidents that we have are because people are just traveling faster than they should for the conditions that are present.
So, well, and I'll put out I'll put out that slow down, especially since construction is trying to wrap up too, and people have a tendency to not observe that posted limit. And gosh, those are people out there. That body does not do well against a big metal hulk. So, plug for those guys as well. Well, yeah. Chief Huff, thanks for joining us this morning for your monthly visit. And is there anything else for you to add, or are we good to go?
I think we're good to go, other than just make sure you attend these upcoming mental health conversations. I think we're going to have a lot of really good information. This affects everybody. So we just really encourage you to get out and help educate yourself and get in those conversations.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. That's Ames Police Chief Jeff Huff joining us for his monthly visit with us. Thanks again, and good luck and safe driving.
Thank you.
All right. Our next guest, we're going to welcome Carol Warm, and I hope I pronounced your last name right. That's the way I would, but is that correct, Kara?
Good morning, Mike. It's actually Kara Warmy.
Warmy, okay. Well, some German pronunciations would be warm. Well, let's introduce you as the Republican candidate. You're running for Story County Supervisor position, and just briefly, if you could let our listeners give us a little bit about your background, if you would.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. So I live just east of Ames, mm-hmm. rural Story County. My husband, Brian, grew up here. My mother-in-law taught at Iowa State in the College of Design for 39 years. I grew up in San Diego in a Navy family. My dad was actually a Navy fighter pilot. And met my mom, believe it or not, at Top Gun, at that same Officers Club bar at Miramar where Tom Cruise and Kelly McGillis meet in the movie. So yeah. They are the real-life version of that. And we grew up there in, you know, amongst the military community in San Diego.
Okay. Now, you say you live in rural Story County, and technically it is rural, but you're really pretty close to 13th Street, for just so folks know. But that would be a good question for you is, are you representing more rural or urban, or who are you planning to represent as a supervisor?
Yeah, you bet. I would love to represent everyone. And you're right. We can throw a stone into city limits, but we also are living on a gravel road, mm-hmm. dealing with a septic system and a well and those things that our rural residents deal with, where this board of supervisors are, you know, are our representative.
Sure. Yeah. You get that Story County gray in your vehicle a little bit. It's what I
yes,
like to call
I
the gravel dust. So yes. You can't tell my vehicle is wine colored right now. It's gray.
Yeah. And we do own some farmland in Story County as well. And I know that's something, you know, that agriculture is so important to people across the county, that they want to feel they have that representation on the board. We're actually, you know, fifth generation farmers with farmland in a couple counties in Iowa. And so, you know, we're watching that rain and watching those policies and everything that's impacting agriculture.
Great. Okay. Your past political experience, you do have, a little bit of that. You were a former U.S. congressional intern. Could you just describe that briefly for our listeners?
Yeah, that was a long time ago. So after my freshman year of college at Stanford, I had started into engineering and thought, wow, this is really hard. And so spring semester of my freshman year, I took U.S. history and public policy, and I went home to San Diego and interned at the district office of a congressman. And it was a fascinating experience. But for me at the time, I thought, nope, I'm sticking with engineering. I want an answer at the end of the page. And I went back and finished my engineering career degree and then did 20 years in business. So it was a little taste in the back. But, you know, moving to Iowa in 2006, you see how much access we have to political candidates and how much great dialogue there is around politics. That people really get to, you know, think it through and make their own choices and meet the candidates, which I think is unique in Iowa.
for our listeners, Kara, could you just briefly explain some of your talking points, say your how your decision making would be, what your leadership qualities are, what your quality of life views are, if you could?
Absolutely. So my style of leadership always starts with asking questions. I have been doing that throughout this campaign, and it's what I would continue to do. I like to seek out different opinions, find experts, find data, ask a lot of questions, and really try to play that devil's advocate, understand both sides of anything, get people moving towards a common vision, and then move with urgency. I have pretty high expectations of myself and of teams I've led. I've supervised people all through my 20 years in business, so that's the experience that I bring, is a lot of leadership, and I like to get the team moving towards a common vision and then, you know, work together towards the solution.
Okay. So it sounds like you're, because of your engineering experience, those kinds of things, that data is important, and having good data. Rural life, climate, soil, things like soil, water, air quality, that's important for all of us. As a supervisor, how would you approach those subjects?
Yeah, they are hugely important right now. And we're lucky to be right here by Iowa State University, where there's so much good research going on. You know, Lisa Schulte Moore just won a genius grant as part of the Cultivation Corridor, right, for her work on prairie strips. Mm-hmm. So I think it's great to see that our growers here in Central Iowa, they have those generations of experience, but they're also very open to getting the latest information and data and equipment and doing what's best to preserve the land. And that's something I want to encourage. I think that a lot of the research that's going on around cover crops and no-till practices and prairie strips, things like that, can really help. I do think it's important that we work in partnership, that we don't, you know, vilify our growers who are feeding us and fueling the world as well. So I think that we can talk to them and work on those things. And then also through Story County Conservation, great work going on there. And that's a priority for me too. You know, that there's a lot of water testing going on and different programs around water quality and education. I think the more we get people outside using our beautiful parks, on the trail, seeing these things that we want to maintain and preserve, that's going to help people have energy to get involved and help with that sustainability effort.
You were mentioning the folks that are growing our energy and growing crops for food that really indirectly feed us because it goes into animals.
Yep.
We've got some of the richest ground in on the planet. And what is your thought about more local food production for people who can actually go from field or from farm to the plate? How would you as a county supervisor go down that road?
Well, as a county supervisor, my focus would be on property owners' rights. You know, mm-hmm. if there are property owners who want to do that, I think that is exciting. You know, as a consumer, I love going to a restaurant that has, you know, a farm to table approach, or visiting a farmer's market and getting those fresh things that you bring home, and they just last so much longer, don't they? And so those kinds of things, I think supporting our local farms, you know, we've got a lot of pumpkin patches, right, that this time of year are selling a lot of those fresh things for people. I think whatever we can do to help people be aware that those businesses are there and encourage them to support our local farmers and our local businesses, that builds the social fabric of our community. It connects people to where their food comes from, and I think that's great.
I know you talk about individual rights, and you mentioned Iowa State and all of the data and information, the unequivocal information about those prairie strips and borders and cover crops. But frankly, I don't see it. I mean, we've been working on that for decades, and I still don't see a lot of those practices. Now, I have a few neighbors who do, and I have some that they get the mole bore plows out there. How would you as a supervisor try to convince folks that we've got to protect this?
I think we can all see as we talk to folks that, you know, generational differences are there. And when you've been doing something a certain way for so long, it is harder to make that switch. I suspect we'll have more luck with our sort of next generation and our younger farmers in trying to, you know, bring things along for folks who maybe are a little more open to trying new things. But I would say that, you know, education is huge, and partnership. You know, I'd have to learn more to see whether there are incentives that we can use to, you know, make it easier for people to maybe have a little less risk when they try some of those things. So are there programs that we can do that would help people to hedge when they want to try something out? I know as I've talked to the folks who farm our fields for us, I get, you know, mixed reviews on, you know, do you lose yield if you go no-till or don't you? You know, one says yes, one says no. And, oh, I tried this cover crop, but then this happened, or one who liked it. So I think they are experimenting, but the more we can do to encourage people and make it worth it for them, because times are tough, right?
Sure.
Like the input costs have gone up so much for these growers that it's hard to take a risk right now, I think.
Yeah. Now, what would you do in an approach for awarding folks who were proactive and actually started doing that before they had to be convinced? I know there are individuals in Story County who have set aside acres and things on their own, and there's no program that award those folks to protect the water and the soils. Would you work on something like that as supervisor?
It's a great idea. It'd be interesting to understand more of what kind of recognition programs that we have in the county and what our options are for that.
Sure.
I think, first of all, just something in terms of saying thank you, right, and being out there and, you know, making an example. Maybe it's a certificate. Maybe it's a visit to your farm, a visit to what you're doing, and highlighting those things. That at least is a good place to start to make sure that people are seen for what they're doing to try to help.
Okay. One last thing. You're going to be a trustee on all the drainage districts in the county. That's what the Board of Supervisors pretty much has been harnessed with. In the last 30 seconds for that, how would you or could you see an improvement in, you know, folks that complain about the drainage districts are actually the same folks who are adding the inputs to make those drainage districts poor condition? 30 seconds on that.
You know, I've met with a lot of past and current supervisors. Everybody says that drainage district is their favorite part, Mike, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's just what they signed up for.
Yeah.
It's complex. You know, I think like all the complex issues here, it's going to take listening to people, using the data, and, you know, trying to represent the broader interests of the county and each property owner and their rights. So I'll be ready to listen and work hard. And would love to have people's votes. Early voting has started.
Yep. Very good. Thank you. Carol Warmy, a Republican candidate for Story County Board of Supervisors. Thank you for joining us and taking time to explain your positions.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You have a great day.
You too. Local Talk, KHOI, provides a platform for citizen and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI, your community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media. I want to thank Mike Murphy for engineering this morning's Local Talk, and a big tug of the toque for producer Lynn Carey for her assistance. I am Mike Metz, and I've been your host this morning. You can find us online at khoifm.org. You can find links to our guests and the information you heard on this program. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris. Thank you for supporting KHOI. We'll see you again on the radio.
Story City Ames and surrounding areas.